This is a podcast from the Refugee Studies Centre. To learn more about our work, please visit www.rsc.ox.ac.uk.
Thank you everyone for coming, and if you do have, with a 30% discount, £38 to spare, this is the book. So I want to talk today about UNHCR as a political actor and even as a security actor. I want to talk about UNHCR from a very international relations point of view, of how an international organization like the UNHCR maneuvers and positions itself in an international environment consisting mostly of actors more politically powerful than itself, so host states, donors, Security Council, etc. And I am arguing in my book, and I'll argue today, that UNHCR is a constantly changing organization as it tries to adopt and adapt to these changes in its international environment. Right now, it seems to be very tough time for humanitarians. High Commissioner Antonio Guterres last year to the Security Council argued on the Syrian crisis that really there wasn't even a possibility for an adequate humanitarian response to a humanitarian crisis on this level. And it occurred to me when I read that how different that point of view was from the one of Sadako Ogata in the 1990s, who was the High Commissioner in that whole period, which was much more of a can-do attitude, that UNHCR would go in there, would be part of the whole UN families, including the Security Council, including the Secretary General's attempt, not just at dealing with the humanitarian crisis, but also the conflict that led to the crisis, the so-called root causes of conflict. So what I want to talk to you about today is very much the politics of refugee situations and the politics of humanitarian operations, the politics of asylum. So UNHCR has a strange mandate. It's created to protect refugees as the guardian of the international refugee regime. Foremost among the duties is to protect the right not to be returned to danger, so non-refoulement. But it's also created explicitly to aid states to deal with the refugee problem and to aid them in a manner that diffuses international, or reduces at least, international tension. It's also completely dependent on states for its funding year by year, and it's usually the same old states. It's the US, Europe, Japan, Canada, the usual suspects. It's also dependent on states, another group of states usually, for access to the displaced. So this is the sort of dilemma that UNHCR, the political dilemma that UNHCR has to live with in every situation it deals with. It has on the one hand a sort of human rights mandate. It has on the other hand both a reliance on states, but also a mandate that it should be there for states. And states and refugees don't always have exactly the same needs. It seems to have managed this dilemma very well. If you look at how UNHCR has grown as an agency over the last 2-3 decades, it's grown immensely in size, in budget, in staffing, in reach in the countries. It's now in 125 different countries. It's become one of the world's biggest humanitarian agencies, and we might forget that today, but in the early 1990s, this was a completely new thing. It happened very quickly. It went from a very small, relatively speaking, small, mostly dominated by international lawyers and organizations that tended to wait on the other side of the border for refugees to flee before it felt it had anything to do with that situation. And then very quickly in the early 1990s, it became an organization that became involved in the midst of some of the biggest wars and conflicts and humanitarian crises, such as Bosnia, such as the Great Lakes of Africa, Kosovo, Iraq, Afghanistan. So I venture to say that refugee problems are very inherently very political problems. The fact that people have to flee and become a refugee is a very political issue. It's a human-made disaster that people flee from. Quite often, refugee movements also have political consequences where they arrive. And one argument in my book is that these consequences have been changing, at least in perception, and states tend to view refugee flows as more and more of a burden, including a security burden, that it can be a threat. So the way Kenya is dealing with Somali refugees, for instance, the way Australia is dealing with boat migrants, it's a very sort of it's a security way of dealing with a problem. You think it's a threat, you defend yourself against it. So there's always been a very political field that UNHCR lives in, but these political interests change. And in the same way, while the words of the UNHCR statute have never changed, they've been the same since 1951, the way in which UNHCR interpret its statute is constantly changing. It's particularly changed in the last couple of decades. And the interpretation changes in response to how state interests are changing. So it's responding to, but it's also trying to be proactive. It's trying to attempt to shape states' perceptions of interest in a way that's more conducive to protecting and assisting refugees. So UNHCR has this perennial balancing act. It needs to remain relevant to the interests of states, because if it doesn't, it won't get funding, it won't get access to the fora where they discuss problems of displacement. So it feels very strongly, all high commissioners talk about the need to remain relevant to donors and also to hosts, refugee host states. But it also, of course, has to remain true to its refugee protection mandate. Otherwise, there's no point in UNHCR existing. But those two go together. It can't choose one and not the other. And the question is, how well does it manage this balancing act? Sometimes better, sometimes worse. And part of what I try to do in the book is discuss, in particular, crisis. Did it fall too far on the side of remaining relevant to state interests? Or did it manage to balance the two sides well enough that it actually made a good difference for refugees and other forced migrants or war-affected populations as well? So just to give an example, don't try to write any of this down. To give an example of how UNHCR's interpretation of its mandate and its role has changed. So this is a quote from 1974 from one of the speeches of Sadruddin Aga Khan, and he's sort of arguing there that UNHCR is a diffuser of security threats, diffuser of difficult situations, that it has this moral task of reducing complex political questions in the minds of nations into simple moral and humanitarian components for the heart to answer. So refugees should not be political, they should be a humanitarian issue, and because we say so, it is. Then in 1983, you had a similar idea, but less on the moral plane, perhaps, more on the practical plane, that UNHCR was a sort of fireman who could try to control the spread extinguish the blaze, or control an epidemic. They can limit the extent of a catastrophe, mitigate its impact, but they can't deal with the causes of why it happened in the first place. In 1986, High Commissioner Hocke, who, this was in a period when UNHCR were becoming, had quite a few problems with the institutional, internal problems, but also with its donors. And it's also a bit harder to know what UNHCR thought their role was. So when they tended to talk along the lines of this quote here, that The refugee problem is very complex, but it's not clear at all from this quote exactly what the various factors are or how UNHCR should be involved in anything or not involved in other things. So a little bit lost, perhaps, and going through its own little crisis. Then came the post-Cold War period, so the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and UNHCR sort of found what they were looking for, or found a sort of new way of pitching their reason to exist, and it was to pitch refugees as a security issue. Sadako Gata suggested the refugee issue has gone beyond the humanitarian domain to become a major political and security issue affecting regional and global stability. And furthermore, UNHCR itself, not just states, could be involved in dealing with this security problem to be a global security actor. So UNHCR, not alone, it never argued it would do anything like that on its own, but in cooperation with states, in cooperation with the Security Council, with peacekeeping forces, with the Secretary General and the political organs of the UN, UNHCR would be an important contributor to a comprehensive and integrated response which linked humanitarian action, human rights, with peacemaking and peace building, and also humanitarian intervention, military intervention. So this was quite a transformation of identity, and it happened very quickly in that period from the late 1980s to the early 1990s. So why did it happen? Well, UNHCR is generally responding to changes in the world around it rather than being all completely at the forefront. So what was happening as UNHCR was taking on this language of security, after the end of the Cold War, there was a real need among security scholars, among state security officials, to think about what will be the new threats. Now that the Soviet Union has gone, now that superpower rivalry has ended, what will be the new threats that are showing up? It wasn't very clear what they would be, and a lot of the talk in the early 1990s was very positive and optimistic, saying we could now have more comprehensive security. Human security hadn't arrived yet, but to talk about our common security and to talk about the Security Council, who could now possibly be effective in stopping some of the wars in the developing world that had gone on for years and years. So a belief in a more humane and inclusive form of security. And a more effective UN. Migrants and refugees very quickly became one of the new refugee issues, which was a bit of a surprise. Tongue-in-cheek, The Economist magazine in 1991 put on its front page a headline saying, "The Russians are coming." And the picture that accompanied this headline was that of huddled refugees in a snowstorm, purportedly arriving from Russia and coming to Europe. And there was a fear in the early 1990s that the end of the Cold War and the fall of the wall, the disintegration of the former Soviet Union, would lead to mass refugee movements to Europe. And there was a real, if you read newspapers from that time, there was a real worry that this was going to happen and it would be so large that countries would not be able to cope. So that was one of the new ways in which migrants and refugees were becoming a new security issue. So not in a positive human security sort of way, but as one of the actual new threats to state cohesion, to identity security. There was a widening of the security concept, which meant it used to be in international relations, when you talked about security, you talked about the integrity of states, sovereignty and their territorial borders. So it was really a political and a military concept. Now suddenly you could have environmental security, you could have identity security, you could have other forms of sort of softer referent objects of security, and not just states. So migrants and refugees would fit as a threat not to the sovereignty of states, but to the identity of the community that lived within the borders of those states. After 9/11, this worry of forced migrants as a possible threat to identity security, to some extent as a threat to economic security. There's a lot of talk in Europe in the 1990s too about asylum seekers swamping social security systems and so on. In 9/11, very quickly led to a backlash against asylum in America, in the UK, in a lot of Western states. None of the terrorists of 9/11 were asylum seekers, but it was very quickly deemed to be a dangerous loophole through which international terrorists could come and enter the country and plot their deeds. So you had a lot of new, quite draconian measures put in place, and also some measures that were already happening that were done to a stronger extent. So, for instance, the detention of asylum seekers, especially if they came from Muslim countries. The use of the exclusion clauses of the Refugee Convention. You saw a whole range of these things happening. Finally, nicer for refugees, the third way, I'd say, in which migrants and refugees have become new security issues as the sort of archetypical victim of insecurity, as a victim of human insecurity. And a lot of both scholars and more sort of refugee advocates suggested that this was a new way in which we could understand the refugee problems. So people like Mary Calder, who wrote about all the new wars, she suggested that refugees were the symbol of human insecurity. Astrid Sürke, another person who was in the vanguard of this idea that refugees should be promoted as victims of human security. And that's also the sort of line that UNHCR tried to take. So that was the changes in ideas and beliefs taking place. There's also a changing operational environment for UNHCR, partly not that things changed itself, but UNHCR went into situations that you didn't used to go into. But there seemed to be more than before, wars of ethnic cleansing and mass displacement, wars where it looked like the displacement of populations was an intrinsic war aim, not just an accidental result of the war. So Bosnia being, and the former Yugoslavia being a good example of that. So this is not new, clearly, it's happened before. But it seemed to be happening very frequently in the 1990s. There's talk of complex emergencies and humanitarian wars. There's a big debate in conflict analysis studies whether complex emergencies and humanitarian wars are a new thing or not. It's partly a complex emergency is new because there are many more actors now involved in humanitarian emergencies than there used to be. So you get this mix of peacekeepers and war fighters and humanitarian organizations of various hues. There has also been many more humanitarian interventions in the last couple of decades than we saw before. Especially in the 1990s, you had a very interventionist Security Council who used, for the first time in its history, humanitarian crisis and refugee movements as a reason to justify intervention, military intervention in countries. For instance, in northern Iraq in 1991, when Kurdish refugees were trying to flee into Turkey, they're fleeing from Saddam Hussein's troops, and the Security Council was part of, suggested that you could have a military intervention in northern Iraq in order to keep the Kurdish refugees safe inside Iraq instead of letting them flee to Turkey, because Turkey did not want any Kurdish refugees on its territory. I think also we've seen, again, it's not new, the political uses of humanitarian aid to win hearts and minds of populations. I'll talk a lot more about this later on, but that's also made UNHCR's and other humanitarian actors' work more difficult. And as I talked a bit about before, there seems to be an asylum. There is an asylum crisis. There seems to be very strong anti-immigration sentiment in many countries, not just in the north, but also in the south. South Africa being one country that I've studied, which had huge riots in 2008 against other African immigrants. So what I do in the book, having gone through how UNHCR's discourse on what the refugee problem is and what its own role should be to deal with the refugee problem, having gone through that, it's no point in looking at discourse and ideas and beliefs unless they actually have an impact on what is then done. So I go through a series of emergencies that UNHCR has played a central role in, and to see how the way they depicted the refugee problem, how they depicted their role, affected what they actually did in these situations, and then what lessons they learned from these humanitarian emergencies. So UNHCR's reaction to all this security talk was not to reject, which many people thought they should, reject the language of security. Because clearly UNHCR should talk about the rights of refugees, not refugees as threat. Instead, what UNHCR did was to try to shape. I guess the idea was you can't stop states from thinking refugees and migrants are a threat. So what we have to do is try to shape that belief in a way that's more conducive to protecting refugees as well. So to be a security actor itself and to be a partner in resolving the root causes of displacement, and to show that UNHCR is relevant to the security needs of states. It's also the power of the language of security, that when you say something is a security threat, you say it's something that needs to be dealt with very urgently. So if you can manage to use this very powerful language to get states to do something about what causes refugee flight, then clearly that would be a really good thing. And that's what UNHCR, and particularly Sadako Ogata, thought was possible in the early 1990s. Although, it's not just about Ogata. People always ask, was this just sort of Ogata's thing? You can see the foundations of this come before her, with Hocke, also with Stoltenberg. And you can see that after she leaves, there's not a sort of decisive break. So it's not just about one woman and her ideas. So the key question is, how does UNHCR balance between the needs of powerful donors and host states and the needs of refugees and others under its mandate? And there's always a debate there between pragmatism and principles, between relevance and legitimacy and credibility. UNHCR has, up through the years, got a lot of flack for not protecting refugees well enough, for being at the helm of some terrible displacement protection failures. So considering that discursive power is UNHCR's main leverage, how does it juggle these two sides of its mandate and its existence? So Ogata was one of the very early champions of human security. So in the case of human security, UNHCR was for a while a bit of a thought leader. Ogata was good at creating alliances with like-minded states and with other organizations in the UN and some NGOs. So for a while, she was really at the helm of this push to make human security the Security Council's new way of doing security, for instance. So this whole security discourse for UNHCR, it's not cynical. I wouldn't say that it's for UNHCR just to be on the side of states and therefore get a lot of funding and be popular with donors and host states. There was a real optimism that security could be solidarity. It could be the security of the most vulnerable, of refugees, not just the national narrow national security concerns of states. And I think if there wasn't that belief, UNHCR wouldn't have gone down this route. So the first two crises, humanitarian crises I look at are in northern Iraq in 1991 and the Bosnia. I don't look at the whole of former Yugoslavia, I just look at Bosnia, from 92 to 95. These were the two crises that really propelled UNHCR into a new role. UNHCR was asked by the Secretary, UN Secretary General, to become lead agency for the humanitarian operations in these two countries. Which was a completely new thing for them to do, because these were not refugee situations, or not first and foremost refugee situations. These were mostly about war-affected populations, sometimes populations trying to flee, but not able to, in the case of northern Iraq, because Turkey would not let the refugees in. So this was UNHCR operating on behalf of all sorts of war-affected people, some of whom were displaced, some of whom were not. Some of those who were displaced were refugees, but others were not. UNHCR created a new vocabulary as part of these operations, using words such as preventive protection, right to remain. So there was a whole new approach there that if UNHCR is serious about resolving refugee problems and dealing with the root causes of flight, it shouldn't have to sit on the other side of the border and wait. It should be able to be proactive and help people remain where they come from, because that's what people want to do, not have to flee. Of course, in Bosnia, it wasn't very easy to protect people who stayed in the middle of a civil war where the warring parties were trying very hard to get rid of the other side's population. So there's a huge humanitarian operation in place, but UNHCR could do very little protection. It could do assistance, it could keep people alive over the cold winter months, and it could give people medicine and blankets and food, but it couldn't really do protection activities. UNHCR worked very closely with military actors in both these conflicts, with NATO, with US forces in Iraq, and with NATO and the peacekeepers in Bosnia, which was a very new experience and a mixed experience. But it was strongly supported by its Western donors in both what it did in northern Iraq and what it did in Bosnia. It was doing what its donors wanted it to do, and they felt it was doing it quite well. And they had very good access to all the different forums, especially on Bosnia. So Sadako Gata was giving speeches to the Security Council regularly. She was in the contact group talking to the states there. So UNHCR was very much involved in all the political negotiations around how to bring an end to this war as well. Now, this might seem strange, but in the case of Bosnia, it was a terrible humanitarian disaster, but UNHCR came to the conclusion after this war that it had a relatively satisfactory outcome in the end. That when I interviewed people at UNHCR, they thought the fact that they had been there on the ground helping people stay alive, they were giving states enough time to find the political solution and finally put enough pressure on Milosevic and get the Dayton Accord. So that was the thinking within UNHCR, that they had been helpful and it had been a relatively satisfactory outcome. One UNHCR staff member I talked to put it this way: UNHCR performed no more than adequately, but much better than anyone else. Therefore, its good reputation after Bosnia. The question is, did UNHCR learn the wrong lesson from Bosnia? Because it's not clear that its humanitarian operation lasting for 3 years was what gave states enough time to come to a political solution. It was when the humanitarian operation was failing, and when Srebrenica fell, and when humanitarian workers could no longer move within the country out of fear of being taken hostage, etc., and the peacekeepers were taken off the ground, that's when you got NATO actually doing more decisive action. That's when you got the Dayton Accord. So it might not have learnt the right lesson from Bosnia. Then came the Great Lakes soon after. After the Rwandan genocide in 1994, about a million people fled over the course of, I think, 24 hours into eastern Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of Congo, and established themselves in huge camps just on the other side of the Rwandan border. These camps were very quickly controlled by the former Rwandan army and the genocidaires who'd also fled together with the civilian Hutu population. These camps became a huge security problem in the region. They were threatening the local population, local Tutsis, other groups. They were also threatening Rwanda. They were using humanitarian resources to sell and barter and to buy weapons, and to they used the refugee camps as their new power base. UNHCR, again, had very good donor support. They got a lot of money, so financially very supportive donors. They did some very important things, such as stopping a huge cholera epidemic in the first months. But politically, UNHCR's donors and the Security Council was very uncommitted. UNHCR asked again and again for military actors to be deployed to demilitarize the camps and take the camps out of the control of the genocidaires. Nothing much happened. In the end, what happened was that Rwanda, together with the Congolese rebels, attacked and killed, no one knows to this day how many refugees were killed in the attack on the camps, but there was at least tens of thousands. And Rwanda did it out of security concerns, but not of the human security type, out of sense that these camps were a traditional threat to territorial integrity and national sovereignty, and they wanted to get rid of the camps. So this led to a lot of thinking within UNHCR. Maybe security arguments were not such a good idea after all. UNHCR was appealing to international peace and security, that this is in everybody's interest to demilitarize these camps. Actually, the Security Council powers didn't have a lot of interest in these camps. There was no high stakes there for them. Rwanda, on the other hand, had very high stakes, and they did something, but they did something that was not very conducive to refugee protection. Then came Kosovo, which is sort of the flip side of the Rwanda coin. In this case, the stakes were a bit too high for UNHCR's donors. The refugees were just too important for NATO to leave to UNHCR. They wanted to be seen to be looking after the refugees themselves. Macedonia and Albania, the two refugee host countries, wanted to use this opportunity to get closer to NATO, to get closer to the EU. So they didn't want to work with UNHCR either. They wanted to work bilaterally with the US and with NATO. So UNHCR had, again, taken on the responsibility as lead agency, which was supposed to coordinate the response to the refugee crisis during the Kosovo War. But it got hardly any resources to do that job, and no one actually listened to what it had to say. It was a very strongly bilateral environment. So if NATO soldiers were not building refugee camps themselves, then the NATO countries were giving money directly to NGOs from their own country. So there's a lot of sort of flag planting in the refugee camps, and a huge array of smaller and bigger humanitarian organizations operating in Albania and Macedonia. So UNHCR fell between two chairs in this case. It was not pragmatic enough for NATO. The humanitarian evacuation program was a program where refugees were immediately airlifted out of Macedonia into various European and North American host states. So it was a sort of quick resettlement program, but they only got 1 year of humanitarian leave to remain. They didn't get refugee status in these countries. So they were lifted out of Macedonia, given a year in other host states. Now, UNHCR didn't like this because it undermined the right to asylum in the first country where you seek safety. And also, it was so quick, there wasn't much of a chance to actually go through and process who were particularly vulnerable groups, etc. So UNHCR was a bit slow to accept this. But in the end, it did accept taking part in it, which meant it was not principled enough for refugee advocates, because it did, in the end, take on responsibility for the humanitarian evacuation program. And in many refugee advocates' view, they therefore undermine the right to seek asylum, because Macedonia was allowed to say, we will only let these refugees in if you take them off our hands. So after Kosovo, again, UNHCR felt felt let down by its donors in a different way. This time, the refugees were okay, mostly. It was a very well-funded operation. Refugees were looked after quite well. It was a wasteful operation. Too much money was spent. But it was not a protection disaster. But in terms of its own relevance and in terms of its own credibility, UNHCR did not feel that it came out of this very well. And it got a lot of criticism after the Kosovo War for being at the helm of this very poorly coordinated and wasteful operation. Here's a picture from Kosovo of a NATO soldier helping looking after refugees. Similar thing going on in Afghanistan in the 2000s, as well as in Iraq. We have soldiers handing out children's school bags, which takes us over to the period after 9/11. Now, a lot of the things that happened in Kosovo happened on a much starker way after 9/11 in Afghanistan and in Iraq. The 9/11 had almost immediate repercussions in the north and in the south for the international refugee regime. I think it's safe to say that the protection environment for refugees, whether they're asylum seekers in the north or whether they are refugees in camps in the south, it was worsening. And many of the trends from the 1990s of the dislike of asylum gained momentum and were given legitimacy, because you could now, instead of talking about the more diffuse worries about identity security and strain on the economy, you can now talk about the potential of terrorist threats. I think this worsening protection environment was compounded by the global economic downturn in 2008. We've seen an even stronger anti-migration trend since then. And refugees now are much less discussed as a separate group than usually now just considered one more type of migrant, usually illegal migrants, because refugees to reach safety tend to have to go illegal routes because there are no legal routes anymore. This is one of the immigration detention centres in the UK. So in terms of repercussions in the north, homeland security, asylum as a terror channel, the exclusion clauses, I talked about all this before, but there was also repercussions in the south, which I will talk about more today. The two wars on terror that took place in Afghanistan from 2001, Iraq from 2003, very quickly became a war between insurgents and US counterinsurgency operations. And that had big repercussions for UNHCR's ability to work. I think there's been a polarization, a lack of trust between different parties that are supposed to work together to allow humanitarians to operate neutrally and based on need rather than political expediency. And as a result, you've had what UNHCR and other humanitarian actors call shrinking humanitarian space, that there is no space for neutral actors to provide humanitarian relief anymore. I think Guterres at one point called it the humanitarian squeeze. I quite like that. We've seen, again, it's not new, But I think in both Iraq and Afghanistan, you've seen a profound blurring of foreign policy aims, war fighting strategy, and humanitarianism. So Pentagon is the biggest aid donor by far in Afghanistan, gives much more money in development and humanitarian aid than any other actor. And it does so to win hearts and minds in counterinsurgency operations, to win over allies, to undermine your enemies, to win over the civilian population to your side. So you have that on the one side, and then on the other side you've had insurgency and terror groups conflating the UN with the US and arguing that it's all part of the same Western interventionist agenda. Now, partly these hearts and mind campaigns have given fuel to this suspicion that the UN is just bidding the US's will. But humanitarians, of course, are also much softer targets than soldiers are. So it became very quickly very dangerous for UN humanitarian actors to be on the ground in Iraq and in Afghanistan and also in many other parts of the world, such as Somalia. Because UNHCR has been clustered, I'm not going to talk about the cluster approach too much today because there won't be time, it was also hard for UNHCR to assert its difference from the other UN actors, to say, look, we are the UN refugee agency, we are just here to protect and help the displaced from the conflict. We have nothing to do with the UN's political arm, we have nothing to do with the US military. Because it was part of this cluster approach, it was harder to assert its difference and its independence. So in Iraq, after the terror attacks on the UN headquarters in Baghdad in 2003, UNHCR became, like the rest of the UN, completely reliant on US military protection to operate within Iraq. So the few international staff that were left by UNHCR in Iraq all moved into the green zone. They were not allowed to leave the green zone without military escort. So they could only leave when the American troops said they were allowed to leave and when they could spare some troops to go with them. They tried to operate through remote control operations where they had local implementing partners, and you would just sort of parachute in now and then and check what they were doing. But there have been a few reports on how that worked out, and it didn't work out very well at all. There was a lot of corruption. There was also signs of some of these implementing partners being too involved in the conflict and helping only one side or the other. There's also an attempt at creating a security culture within UNHCR of thinking security first, and all sorts of new security guidelines were issued, and in effect, in a place like Iraq, it meant you could really not do very much at all. One UNHCR staff member who operated in Iraq, who was in the green zone, said to me, "How objective can you be when you fly in a Black Hawk helicopter? It is impossible for UNHCR to talk about themselves as an independent, objective, neutral, humanitarian actor when they arrive with American soldiers." And they were putting their implementing partners at risk by going to visit them. So there was really no space at all for independent and principled humanitarian action. So UNHCR decided, I think, this is my interpretation, that in order to stay credible as an independent, principled humanitarian actor, they had to keep their distance to the whole Iraq operation. They did not become very heavily involved as a humanitarian actor inside Iraq. They sort of gave up on it. They also tried to diversify their donor base, tried to get donors from the Gulf states, among others, with differing success. They also tried to get more support from private actors, such as the IKEA Foundation, which again they've had some success, but still it's dwarfed by the usual suspect donors. So in the case of Iraq, UNHCR chose distance and diversification rather than presence and visibility. And it did actually stand up to the US in 2008, where there was daily pressure for it to say after the surge that it was now safe for refugees to go back to Iraq. And UNHCR in the end put out a report saying it is absolutely not safe and people mustn't force Iraqi refugees to return. And then it decided instead to focus on Iraqi refugees outside the country and use more of its effort there. So back to a more traditional refugee organization. Not that it was perfect what it did that, but it found it was less controversial and it could do more. In Afghanistan, you had a similar, not as stark, but also a worsening security situation from about 2003. UNHCR did not have access, by sort of 2005, it didn't have access outside of the urban centers in most parts of Afghanistan. So again, it was trying to use remote control operations. And again, they were very corrupt. WikiLeaks has released some of the auditing reports from some of these operations. And it's clear that UNHCR, the auditors, see that these are very corrupt, and among the most corrupt are the Afghan Department for Refugees. But they find it tolerable. It's very corrupt, but yes, it's still some of the money goes out, and it's the only way they can operate. So remote control operations have continued in Afghanistan, despite being quite flawed. I mentioned before UNHCR's aid budget was dwarfed by that of the Pentagon. And there have been quite a few reports out lately about how wasteful that aid has been. It's aid used for political purposes rather than purely development and humanitarian needs. It's very often corrupt. It's used to bolster allies and weaken enemies. It's used for very short-term gains rather than long-term strategies. There's this fund called SERP, the Commander's Emergency Response Program, which is money that US commanders can just dip into to use if they need in a particular village to get the village elders to become more positive, more friendly. In 2010, $1.2 billion was at the disposal and spent by military commanders, and the whole of UNHCR's Afghanistan, and that's just the SERP fund. There's lots of other Pentagon money being spent in on aid, and UNHCR's Afghanistan budget that same year was $70 million. So again, very difficult to come across as an independent humanitarian actor when what most people see and what insurgents see and what the Taliban see is aid used for political and military purposes. So the Kosovo lesson for UNHCR was that when stakes are high, UNHCR has little relevance. It doesn't really matter whether they talk security or not, they will get pushed to the sideline. And in the case of Iraq and Afghanistan, stakes were even higher for UNHCR, so there's very little chance that it could find that right balance between principles and relevance. So much more important for UNHCR became then to try to retain some credibility as a protection agency, which meant to sometimes actually do less rather than more. So keep its distance from the US agenda. One thing Guterres has done as High Commission is to try to show that he isn't there just for the main donors. One of the first speech he gave as a High Commissioner was in Uganda, rather than in Brussels or Geneva or somewhere. He talks very much of international solidarity, and he talks very much about the needs of host states. So he's trying very much to create this distance to the Western donor agenda. That said, UNHCR has become an enormous humanitarian organization, and it wants to stay that way. It doesn't want to shrink. No bureaucracies ever want to shrink. So it's still a very pragmatic organization and pragmatic in its response to emergencies. I think protection is still very often on the back burner because it's very often difficult to achieve, especially now that many displacement crises are internally displaced people rather than refugees, which makes it very difficult for UNHCR to to push through protection. And again, with the clustering, protection is not a very important part of the clusters. So it seems that UNHCR's more modest goal is to add some value, both for states and refugees. And if they feel they can add that value for both sides, then it might go in. So I'll finish by talking about the Afghan repatriation operation that's been taking place over the last decade, or since 2001, really. UNHCR has been at the helm of this repatriation operation. Of 5.7 million refugees have been returned, apparently, by now. So what was the space for principled action here? Well, if you look at states' interests in 2001, it was very much all states involved, whether host states, whether donors, whether Afghanistan's new government, it was that Afghan refugees should go home. So that was pretty clear. It was also in UNHCR's interest. After Kosovo, it needed a success. And to have a successful repatriation operation, where one of the longest standing refugee operation situations in the world could be resolved, it would be an amazing success for UNHCR. It would show its relevance and its principles, because voluntary repatriation is supposed to be the preferred solution to refugee problems. So how did UNHCR fare? How voluntary were actually the repatriations? How sustainable were they? And did UNHCR actually influence this process, or did they just administer it? What voluntary repatriation means can be quite difficult to gauge sometimes. I think the scales have been sliding in the case of the Afghans. First of all, it's become much harder for refugees to stay in Pakistan and Iran. So the pressure from host states to leave is much, much stronger than it used to be. In the case of Pakistan, the refugees are now in a much more lawless and disorderly region than they used to be. In Iran, lots of people have been deported, and there are much fewer job opportunities because of Iran's economic problems. At the same time, for those who've been in exile for a long time, so since 1979, or who've been born in exile, there's been very little reason to go back to Afghanistan. I mean, what does it mean to go back to a country you were never born in the first place? The other question is, UNHCR was supposed to facilitate return rather than encourage it, because it's supposed to be voluntary and the refugees are supposed to decide themselves. But there's, again, from WikiLeaks, it's quite clear that the refugees often fear that these cash grants that UNHCR gave would stop if they didn't leave soon, that you'd have these windows where if you left now, you would be given support, but if you waited too long, then maybe you wouldn't get that support. Refugees also quoted harassment and violence by their host states as a reason for returning, so that also makes you wonder how voluntary was it. But another question is, who is a refugee? UNHCR's very pragmatic answer seems to have been those who have refugee ID cards are refugees, the others are not. The problem is the only way you could get a refugee ID card was to go into one of the refugee camps. And especially during the Mujahideen period, the Soviet invasion, if you went to the camps, you had to join the Mujahideen in order to get a refugee card. Some for that reason, and some for reasons of wanting to get a job and so on, they didn't go to the refugee camps, they went into the city centres. And they've never been counted as refugees. But their reasons to leave are, I would argue, exactly the same as those who went into the camps. But only those with refugee ID cards were now counted as refugees by UNHCR. There's also an argument made by people in UNHCR and others, weren't Afghans better off going home? I mean, yes, it's not very safe in Afghanistan, but it's not very safe where they were either, so shouldn't they just go home? Again, a very pragmatic way of thinking. I think the repatriation has not been wholly voluntary, especially after the first rush. So the first sort of couple of million, I think, were definitely voluntary. People, UNHCR could hardly keep up as people were moving home. But after that, there's been a lot of push. And there's also been a lot of deportation from Iran and a closing of refugee camps in Pakistan. And I think by equating refugee status with owning a refugee ID card, UNHCR managed to avoid the whole question of refoulement. It didn't have to protest when hundreds of thousands of people were deported from Iran, because Iran was very careful to only deport people who didn't have the refugee ID cards. The sustainability of return has not been good. There's a sharp rise in urban poverty. Kabul has been the fastest growing city in the world, apparently, and it's mostly these huge slums growing up around the city of people who've people who've come in from Afghanistan, from Pakistan and Iran. Again, UNHCR's protection mandate is not very visible. It's very hard for UNHCR to do protection activities because they are in danger themselves there as well. A lot of their work has to be done remotely. There's been a lot of killing of humanitarian personnel in Afghanistan. But I argue, and it's a very Weasley argument, I guess, but it's likely that the situation would have been worse if UNHCR had not been involved, both for the returning refugees and for interstate relations. Again, if you look at the WikiLeaks documents of American diplomatic cables from Kabul and from Pakistan, you see UNHCR plays this quiet diplomacy role of bringing parties together, ironing out some differences, getting people to work. So they are doing some good, but they are not being particularly principled and sort of standing up for the rights of voluntariness and so by doing so. But I still think it would have been a worse situation for everyone involved if UNHCR hadn't been there and hadn't had very competent people working on the ground there. So that's where we're standing right now, a much more pragmatic organization, less certain of what good it can do in the world, but becoming, if you're in Syria now, it's again in charge of a huge humanitarian operation. Its budget is now $5.3 billion, I think, last year. So it's, you know, it's doing very well in terms of getting funding and running major camps. But we're still at the stage where its protection mandate seems to be on the back burner. So I'll leave it at that and open for questions. Thank you.
For more information about the different ways you can stay updated and engaged with the work of the Refugee Studies Centre, please visit www.rsc.ox.ac.uk/connect.